That's so cool.
Good afternoon. I call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It's Thursday, February 4th. Good afternoon. So we have a pretty full agenda today, so we are going to get started right away. Planning on starting with a work session on 4136. So we'll open a work session on House Bill 4136, and I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield moves House Bill 4136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah. What did we hear as far as the fiscal on it and those determinations? Also, did we discuss whether or not this is retroactive in what it's doing? Like, is it only cases going forward, or what about pending cases currently?
And the language of the bill, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
The language of the bill describes on what causes of action when this will occur. If you... amendments, let's see here. When a judgment is entered before the effective date of 2016, there it is. It's whether the cause of action arose before, on, or after the effective date of the 2016 act.
So that would be retroactive to...
No, it would not.
If there's... Well, if it occurred on...
Or after.
Or after. On before or after, based on what you just said,
would be... Let's see here.
Before. So if a judgment hasn't been issued... Then this could affect current pending cases that are happening as we speak.
Misheard you.
Okay. Yeah. It's
no, it's on or after.
It's on
yeah,
or after.
On or after.
Not on
it's
before.
It's not
or
on
after.
Or before, it's on or after.
And that's for the judgment. Sorry, I'm trying to get it. We just moved really quick. I'm trying to get it pulled up. So
if you look at section 2, if you read that of the bill. Once you get it pulled up.
Arose, whether the cause of action arose before, on, or after the effective. And so that would mean things that have already happened. I don't know. I'm reading it. I'm just not understanding how that doesn't mean before. The judgment was entered before the effective. Do not apply. Right. And so if I'm looking at
just making sure.
Line 13, 12 and 13, it says the act do not apply to causes of actions which a judgment was entered before the effective date. So if a judgment has not been entered on it yet, then this would apply to those. So therefore, you would conclude that it would apply to things that are currently pending.
Okay, wait a minute. Okay. I'm not a lawyer. But the way you're reading that to me, are you looking down at 12 and 13?
Yes, I'm looking at section 2, lines 9 through 13.
Okay, well, go down because what you're talking about is really lines 12 and 13. It says the amendments to this section of the ORS, okay, section 1 of this 2016 Act, do not apply to a cause of action for which a judgment was entered before the effective date of this 2016 Act.
Right. Thank you. So it's saying a judgment entered. So that means that there could be things right now that are in court that a judgment has not been entered that are being disputed that this would affect.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right, and that, if you think about it, it only makes sense because this is a cap that applies to what a jury would award. So if a jury has not yet awarded something, it wouldn't make sense to have a case that maybe has a trial date 8 months from now, and we pass the bill, and then that jury 8 months from now awards $1.1 million in non-economic damages in a wrongful death case, and then we apply the cap, even though there's been no cap for the 8 months prior to while that case was in litigation. So this is a law that affects only the final judgment, the jury award. So I think it it definitely would not go back and retroactively if a judgment had been previously entered, but certainly I think it's fair to say that there are cases that are filed or in negotiation right now that after the effective date of this act, there would be a higher cap.
Follow up.
Yeah.
I'm still getting used to the dialogue back and forth on work sessions here and proper protocol. If we go back to when we were discussing insurance policies and limit amounts and so forth, I would imagine that there are physicians and other industries that have purchased a policy with a specific limit amount, maybe of $1 million or something like that, you know, with the expectation that they have coverage to that. So if this suddenly goes to 1.5 and it exceeds the policy amount they have right now, and we have an emergency effect, so they don't have time to go out and change what their policy is, doesn't that mean that that leaves them vulnerable where somebody could come after them, their personal property and so forth,
if
it exceeds?
Madam Chair. Right now, we don't have a cap on non-economic damages for all general personal injury cases. And so in this situation, people have insurance. And so I think the real thing that we heard in the testimony is when you have someone who has, whether they've been seriously injured to where like a loss of, where they've severely been disabled, where they're going to need medical treatment indefinitely for the rest of their life or care for the rest of their life, that type of non-economic damages, the effect and harm that has been caused through their life by a wrongdoer, that is not capped at all. And so if that were to occur currently, we already have insurance policies that are in effect that would be able to access this. This is only a small subset of claims of the personal injury realm, which is the wrongful death realm. So for this, there are already insurance policies in place to take account for the areas of the law, in fact, the majority of the areas of law that do not have caps in place.
I followed about half of that. My brain's a little slow on some of this, but fair enough. You know, I have some concerns about a lot of the details that I think that were not there. So when we vote, I'm going to be a no. So I don't know who all was in the room when the motion was actually made. So
yeah, we are under a motion. We're in discussion on the motion. Mm-hmm. So further discussion.
Have we considered the -1 amendment?
There has been no motion. We are on a motion on the underlying bill.
Can I make a motion for it to consider the -1 amendment?
I don't. That we are already in a motion on the underlying bill, which we started 10 minutes after committee was scheduled to start. So we are on
the
underlying
bill. We have two motions
on
the table at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Victoria says that's outside of protocol.
Can we stand at ease, please?
Sure, we'll stand at ease for a moment. Okay, we are back, and we are in discussion on the motion on the table, which is a do-pass recommendation to the floor for House Bill 4136. We have consulted with the House clerk, and it is out of order to consider the -1 amendment because we are on a motion on the underlying bill, so we will continue discussion. Further discussion? Okay, seeing none. Would you, clerk, call the roll?
Representative Holby?
The clerk said.
Aye.
Representative Boyle?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative Rayfield?
Yes.
Representative Stark?
No.
Representative Vice Chair Bueller?
No.
Sorry.
Him too is no.
All three of those.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes, for the second time.
Sorry, Chair Fagan.
Yes, and so the motion passes. Representative Gygos, would you like to carry the bill on the floor? All right, thank you. All right, and with that, so we are, just to give everyone a heads up, you already took it off the agenda. Okay, never mind. So with that, we are going to we're going
to
go a little bit out of order, out of respect for Representative Buckley. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4041. Go ahead and give us the bill. Sorry.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4041 removes products of seed from statute prohibiting local governments from inhibiting or preventing production of seed, modifies exemption to that statute, and declares an emergency. As effective on passage, we have proposed Dash 1 amendments that delete growing from regulated activities and remove changes to ORS 633.741 referring to local measures.
Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. I'm sorry to see Rep. Nierman cause so much confusion on that last bill. I hope this one's more straightforward. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm bringing this bill forward. Ever since the whole argument happened over Senate Bill 863 in 2013, I've been trying to call attention to the language that we put in the statute concerning products of seed. The language in the bill states that only state government can regulate the products of seed. There's no definition of what products of seed means. Is products of seed, is it hemp seed oil? Is products of seed, what exactly is the product of seed? Is it every plant and tree that's grown in the state of Oregon? I'd like to clarify that. I'd like to have the statute clarify what we're discussing when we're talking about the product of seed. This bill basically is not about seeds. This bill does not impact what a farmer can or cannot grow, what seeds a farmer can or cannot plant. It talks about changing the language in statute to make it clear that a city can have a tree policy. Or a county can make a choice if it needs to on an agricultural issue that's important to that county. So I'm hoping that the committee will listen to the testimony on this bill and consider the legal issues involved. We are already seeing cases brought to court to contest the legislation that we passed, the Senate Bill 863. 863 was meant to add clarity to the law regarding the regulation of seeds, but it's added a level of confusion as to the local language, and we're going to see more and more legal conflicts as local governments and individuals seek to protect their own rights and interests. There are no changes in this bill to the state's regulation of seeds. Emphasize that again. The bill only seeks to remove a term that should never have been included in a bill claiming to regulate only seeds, a term that was never defined in statute. Again, Madam Chair, members, we're seeing lawsuits. There's a lawsuit right now in Southern Oregon on this. We're going to see more and more lawsuits as this bill, this undefined line, comes into contention when people say, well, we want to have this sort of regulation in our city on trees. And someone will be able to say, well, you can't do it. If you want to do this with your urban forest, you can't do it because only the state can do it. So I'd love to get some clarification on that. I appreciate your consideration of this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for Representative Buckley? Yes, Representative Nierman.
So thanks for your testimony, Representative. And I'll try not to cause any more trouble or confusion or anything like that. But as far as products of seed go, so this bill doesn't give a definition to products of seed, and so you claim to be I don't want to put it that way. You're trying to clean up the language and get rid of the litigation and all that. But just the way I read this, it's kind of a pothole for litigation because you don't have a definition of products of seed there yet. It still refers to products of seed, and ultimately the kingpin I think is if I was a court, how could I not consider a seed to not be a product of seed? How do you get a seed other than from a seed?
Madam Chair and Member Senator, yes, I would think a product of seed could be seed. That's absolutely accurate. And I don't think we'd change that by changing the language that we're offering in this bill. An example I'd give you, Representative, in the marijuana discussions that we've had over and over again, we finally reached a point where we said, well, okay, let's give counties and cities the opportunity to opt out. So in that case, that is a plant that we are saying to cities and counties, you can regulate this crop if you choose to do so, this agricultural crop. It doesn't say you can regulate marijuana seeds. It's not an issue of seeds. It's an issue of the crop. That same idea should be consistent, I believe, with every other plant as well, that cities and counties should have the opportunity to have local control over what is grown in their vicinity.
Can I follow? Mm-hmm. So this would gut the grand bargain going back to 2013. It would gut that then, right? It would say that local counties could pass an ordinance regulating seed then, right?
Representative, they could not pass an ordinance regulating seed, but they could pass an ordinance on trees and plants. And it would also be on crops, too. For instance, if there was an instance where are farmers whose crops might endanger another farmer's crop, a local government would be able to say, we need to regulate this so both farmers can grow what they wish to grow. The city would, or county would, have the ability to do so.
May I follow again? You said endanger. What does that mean? Endanger, you mean cross-pollinate?
Cross-pollinate.
So it does gut the intention of the state preemption in the grand bargain.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, because a county would not be able to regulate what a farmer could or could not plant. The regulation on GMO seeds would still be in place. Only the state would be able to regulate GMO seeds.
Okay. Thanks. I have some more questions, but on a different line, so I'll get in the back of the queue if there's a queue.
Okay. There actually was Representative Holdy, and then...
Yeah, so for clarity, this bill doesn't regulate products of seed. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, represents exactly it. This bill does not regulate the products of seed. It allows city and county governments to have control over trees, plants, bushes that are grown in their vicinities.
Follow up. And so if I'm hearing you correctly, that right now it could be questionable whether local governments have any authority over any agricultural product, weeds, trees, like an ordinance for keeping your lawn cut, those sorts of things?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly it. And you could even go so far as to say, with the language that is now in statute, could linseed oil be only regulated, you know, by the state, or cornmeal? Can there also be local control of other products of seed besides plants? Right now, it's very unclear, given the statute we have. The statute is so far-reaching in Senate Bill 863, it pretty much says anything that's grown in the state of Oregon can only be regulated by the state government.
So just one last. And so this would return to local government, their local control over that.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. So again, as you brought up the issue of a lawn ordinance that a city might wish to do, under my reading of Senate 863, the city is not able to do that. They could be sued by citizens who say to the city, "You can't regulate what I do with my lawn. Only the State Department of Ag can."
So I wouldn't have to fix my lawnmower. Thanks.
Sounds like a little self-interest there, Representative, in your questions. Representative Nierman?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So this is, now I take back what I say about not causing any more trouble. Representative Buckley, this bill seems to belong in the Agriculture Committee. Why is it before the Consumer Protection Committee? Do you have any opinion on that or any knowledge on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, I think that in regards to people who purchase lawn seed, people who purchase products for their garden, people who decide to have pear trees in their consumers who participate in gardening have a say in this bill. Like I said, I believe the most of the contentious possible litigation is going to be over an individual's right to petition their local government for a particular use of an agricultural or floral product.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
And to accommodate other members who are in the audience, so I know there's a lot of people who want to testify on this bill, but we're juggling a few different things and members who need to actually get back to their committee. So at this point, we're going to keep that public hearing open, but we're also going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4065. Representative Witt, I'm going to read us a quick summary of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4065 establishes procedures for contracting agencies to determine if contractors are delinquent in payments to state agencies and require payment of account development of payment plan prior to awarding public contract. Requires contracting agency to notify state agency of action. Requires state agency to direct Department of Revenue or private collection agency to cease efforts to collect amounts due upon receiving notice. Becomes operative January 1st, 2017. We have proposed Dash 1 amendments that add the word state before the phrase contracting agency wherever it appears.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31, appearing in front of you this afternoon in support of House Bill 4065. This bill is a response to the September 2015 Secretary of State's audit report. That report finds that over 9,000 vendors who owe our state money continue to be authorized to receive payments from the state of Oregon. The report concludes that, quote, from 2011 to 2014, Oregon could have collected $3 million had vendor offsets been in place. The report then goes on to state that it feels that that $3 million figure is conservative and explains the reasons why. And you have excerpts from that report in front of you that you can read that detail. One example given in the report is a vendor who owed the state, received from the state $1.4 million while owing the state $250,000. The fact that there are so many vendors owing the state money, oftentimes considerable amounts of money, yet continue to do business with the state and profit from that business, makes no sense, not only to the Secretary of State's office, but to the general public, to the press. And I would call your attention to yesterday's Willamette Week article discussing this very topic. And it doesn't make any sense to myself. I suspect that it may not make sense to some of you. What House Bill 4065 does is instruct state agencies to check with legislative fiscal office to determine whether or not a vendor owes the state money prior to letting a contract. Now, if a vendor or potential vendor is found to owe money and wishes to continue as a vendor status with the state of Oregon, then the bill provides those individuals with two options. They can pay up front, open their checkbook, and write a check. Or they could assign money from the next contract to the state to bring their account up current. Again, according to the Secretary of State's report, quote, at least 40 other states have implemented a state vendor offset program. They are most often highly automated programs with little overhead. Our research, discussions with other states, and interviews with Oregon officials suggested widely available tools, that Oregon could pursue to increase collections. Among the most promising, and then it lists a list of items, again, in your excerpt there. First on that list, a vendor offset program. I suggest to you that this will impact not only debt that's owed the state, meaning additional revenue, but also future proclivities, perhaps, to cheat, delay payments, however you choose to characterize that. An example of the success of this kind of program, again in your excerpt, was North Carolina, where one FTE in 2014 resulted in the collection of $1.6 million. One person, $1.6 million, highly automated program, doesn't take a lot to run it, low overhead. Committee members, House Bill 4065 will collect real and substantial revenue for our state, avoid future tax cheats, And I think perhaps as important, if not even more important, help level the playing field for those who always play fair. I urge your support for House Bill 4065. Would be happy to try and answer questions if you have them.
Representative, thank you. Representative Nierman.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Witt, thanks for your testimony, and I'm inclined to get behind the idea. So, how is the state ready for this? So, do we have that highly automated one FTE, easy to implement solution that stores the list of delinquent contractors? Or,
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, an absolutely excellent question. If you read your excerpts, it points out the Secretary of State's office has been making this recommendation now for 2 decades. We have not done it, largely because we continue to be exceedingly challenged by our state's computer program. And at some point, we have to make a decision. Are we going to allow an antiquated computer system in this state to continue to enable the state to live in an era 2 decades ago, or are we going to bite the bullet and move forward and get that kind of software that is necessary, and as the report suggests, is readily available? Are we going to bite the bullet and actually do that 2 decades after the original recommendation?
So thank you for that. So then the answer is no. We don't have that list there. And I'll just put words in your mouth, and you can take them out, spit them out if you want. You're hoping that the enactment of this law will be a driver for the acquisition of that software, that system to deal with that. Then
it will be, Madam Chair, Representative Nierman. It will be a driver, but I also want to underscore the point and encourage everyone again to read the excerpt. In doing the audit, the Secretary of State's office went through the process themselves that it would take for the various state agencies to undertake this process. They did not in any way seem to be challenged with their ability to do that. We need to, quite frankly, update our computer system in this state, and it's not anywhere as close to being an insurmountable problem.
Yeah. Well, actually, Representative Holby first, sorry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Representative Witt, for bringing this bill forward. And just for clarity, I think you can answer this. The way I read this bill, it would not apply to a subcontractor who is contracting with the contractor who has the public contract. So the subcontractor could be in some list, but if they're not the prime contractor, it would not apply to them. Maybe a topic for another day, but
no. But Madam Chair, Representative Holby, you're correct. It is the debtor of record.
Follow up. I was trying to make it clear that that this applies to a prime contractor and not somebody who that contractor would subcontract out to perform the work, actually.
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, yes, it is. It would be that prime who is the debtor of record.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. Representative, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. Who's responsible for this activity? I mean, the report says Oregon's not using some proven collection tools regardless of our antiquated information systems. But there are some very simple collection tools that are listed here that aren't being followed. So who's responsible?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buehler, I anticipated that question, and I been wondering how I was going to answer it. I think all of us. And I think when I first entered the legislature 11 years ago, I was appointed to the Information Technology Committee. And I was shocked. And the more I learned, the more I was scared. And quite frankly, if we gave it serious consideration of how antiquated we are in terms of our computer technology in this state, I don't think any of us could go to sleep at night. It is that bad. And I think that oftentimes, and this is one person's viewpoint, there may be 100 others that think entirely differently, but I think it has been easier for us to allow the antiquated system to drive our decision making rather than to make decisions on what would be best, the best way to run much of our state.
Maybe I wasn't clear enough. I'm not. Let's untangle the information system problem.
Mm-hmm.
There are simple techniques for collection of debts that are outlined here elsewhere that could be utilized. Like they list internet posting of major debtors.
Mm-hmm.
The other states apparently have done this and receive payment because no one wants their name out there as a debtor to the state of Oregon. Not being done, and a couple other techniques. Who is responsible for basic instituting basic collection tools for the state of Oregon? I don't think we need to hold people accountable, but we're not an operational body in the legislature. Who is supposed to be taking care of those types of operational functions for the state of Oregon with regards to collecting debts?
Ultimately, it would be our Department of Revenue. But I also think that now that we are, all of us, collectively aware of it, I think we have an obligation as legislators as well to see to it that, to the best of our ability, we set the ship back on course. And I think that there needs, if I may, Madam Chair, I think we would be well served perhaps by having a work group take a look at not only this problem, but a number of other problems that we have related to technology. And I understand, Vice Chair Buehler, that you're trying to separate that. But it's very difficult to separate that from the policy decisions that have been made. And again, I do seriously believe that we have allowed, because it's easier, maybe it's cheaper, to allow an antiquated system to drive our decision making. It's, excuse the French, bass backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to turn that around. It's long overdue to turn that around.
Chair Fagan, do we have someone from the Department of Revenue who's going to be testifying with regards to this bill?
No, nobody signed up.
Can we make that request to have someone?
I mean, it's a public hearing, so I don't. Certainly, they can testify if they want to. I don't know that we can direct anyone to testify.
We need to call them. You could call them if you wanted to have somebody come over.
We don't have a subpoena.
I don't have a subpoena. It's nicely asked someone that we would like to ask some questions about this proposal.
So. Is there anyone in the room today with that department? You got a cowboy hat, I see. Maybe no. Okay, I just thought I'd take a shot.
If they were here, would they admit it?
Madam Chair, and Vice Chair Buehler, if I might too. It's always easy to be critical, but I never intended, I'm sure you never intended, I'm sure none of the people in this room ever intended not to provide, adequate tools, including the revenue. But we need to, all of us determine that pathway and then provide the necessary tools to get there. And as I said earlier, I think it's all of us.
Do you have a follow-up?
I respectfully agree in one way and disagree in another. It's all of our responsibility, so I'm trying to be responsible.
Yes.
It says this is our sixth, the Secretary of State says this is our sixth collections-related audit since 1997.
Yeah.
We still have a major problem.
Yes.
And I want to be fair and give the people who should be responsible a opportunity to express their opinion about this Secretary of State audit, and also do my job as a fiduciary legislator to hold them accountable.
Mr. Chairman.
And I can't do that unless they're sitting in that position.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Buehler, I certainly understand that. Your point is well taken. The recommendation hasn't changed, I think, as you've correctly pointed out, over a series of decades. And is my opening comment in response to your question, as I anticipated the question, and I'm still left without an adequate answer.
So let's go ahead and transition and focus on the content of the bill, because we have a limited amount of time and we have about four people in the queue. And I just want to make sure that I understood it correctly, that 40 other states have something similar in
place. That's correct.
Okay. Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you bringing this. And to the last dialogue, I feel like that what we're hearing here on this bill is an attempt to go forward with recommendations from the audit. And we've seen that there have been a number of audits and that it's important to go forward with some of those recommendations. And two of them that were interesting to me, first of all, this audit indicated that there were a lot of different things we could do. And one of them was to collect the debt and to give strategies to the department to, you know, go ahead and collect the debt. And I believe that's what this bill is attempting to do. And it gave some recommendations very clearly that maybe other audits have given before, but it seems to me that this bill and Representative Witt are trying to implement some of those recommendations. And the recommendation is that up to this point, Oregon hasn't had strategies and or focus on collecting debt. And so this bill will give another tool in the toolbox to be able to collect that debt. And it indicated an agency that they thought would be the best agency for it with the supplies and resources we have. And it also talks about making sure they report back to the policymakers so we can take more actions on making sure that we have strategies and we have things in place to help collect the debt. So this wasn't a question. It was simply a comment. But I'm really pleased that Representative Witt has gone beyond an audit and has given us something to work on and think about to produce something that will help collect the debt.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hoyle.
I was going to say what Representative McLean said.
Would you like to say it again, Representative Hoyle?
I don't think that's necessary, but thanks for asking.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you, and thank you for your attention and concern over this matter. Appreciate it.
We'll call up Tracy Rutt and Brian Krieg.
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, for the record, Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to be very brief and say that we had some initial concerns with the bill as drafted. We talked to Representative Witt about those concerns, and the Dash 1 amendments address those concerns. So we are neutral on the bill with the Dash 1 amendments and appreciate his efforts to address those issues. Thank you.
Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Brian Krieg, today representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, also known as SMACNA. As we, yes, everyone loves the name SMACNA. In looking at this, the bills that were coming up for this session, I didn't think that this one was going to register very high in front of my contractors. But I was surprised a little bit by the fact of the interest that they had in that they do see problems out there in level bidding fields of bidding against people for public contracts where the other player has not been playing fair. This is a good government bill. And the issue has come up many, many times. There has been many different attempts at trying to use collections agencies and other things over the years to get to those large debt numbers that the state is owed out there in various different areas. So in looking at this bill, it doesn't, as Representative Holvey had pointed out, doesn't get to the subcontractors. But my contractors sometimes are subcontractors, sometimes they are generals. So they would encourage you to take a look at this bill and look at this policy and move forward with it. Would be fair? Contracting with the state and the public is a privilege.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing no questions, thank you both for your testimony. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and leave the public hearing and work session open on this bill, and we're going to transition back to, let's see here, it's House Bill 4041.
No. Let's do 4090, open a public hearing on House Bill 4090.
Okay. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 4090.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4090 prohibits declaration or bylaws of planned community or condominium from requiring owners to water or irrigate lawns, gardens, or other landscaped areas.
Thank you. Representative McLean, I was going to allow you to testify out there. It would have been much easier.
Oh, that was, but I didn't know you were going to do that. I thought I had to follow all the rules.
So. Well, it's good to see you.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, thank you very much. This committee, as I indicated the other day with the opening of some of our hearings in January and then information in previous meetings, we have a wide variety of items that affect our general public. We have a wide variety of items that actually affect our consumers and our citizens in all of our communities. And the one that I'm bringing to you today, which is 4090, is one that deals with conservation of water and rights of homeowners. And so I do want to talk about that just for a little bit. We are basically seeing some drought conditions, and we have been seeing some declarations of droughts in the state of Oregon. This last summer is the driest summer that I remember in my lifetime. I saw trees that had very poor years because of the lack of water in a variety of places in Oregon that usually have not experienced that kind of drought. And so that was a big change for us, I think, on the Willamette Valley side, where folks on the eastern Oregon, central and south parts of our Oregon state really have had some of these conditions before. 26 out of the 36 counties were declared drought counties this last year. There is some situations where I've had a few citizens, and folks who have also been contacting cities as well as the League of Cities, who have indicated that their homeowner associations are requiring them to actually water or irrigate their land that they own, land that is theirs, to a certain level of greenness. And if they do not water or irrigate their land to that certain level of greenness, then they are either fined or they are at least restricted or are told that they're doing something that's against their agreement as a homeowner association. When I looked at that, I looked at both the issue that when they joined the homeowner association, they did take on some responsibilities of being part of a group or a community. And totally understanding that, I wanted to make sure that this was a different condition than some of the other items that were actually covered in some of those agreements. One item that seemed to stick out to me was that we're dealing with a conservation issue, we're dealing with a limited resource issue, and we're dealing with a rights issue that has a lot to do with how high is the water bill going to be on a particular year? How much are we going to be using of a very scarce resource, water, on our lawns when some folks are having hard times having enough water for drinking water in their communities, or water for their agriculture, or water for other
reasonable needs, including the rivers and the streams, and making sure that those are cool enough to be habitats that are good for our fish and trout and other areas. I would like to simply say that the solution seemed to be that we suggest that homeowner associations not be allowed to make their owners actually water or irrigate to a certain level of greenness. When working on this bill, I worked with both Senator Hansel, who has another bill, who has a couple of triggers that is only on when we have droughts declared. This one was to look at both short-term needs and also to look at the long-term need of actually starting to think about how we use water, when we use water, and what we use water on. And this bill is in front of you because of that desire to have both short and long-term need met. I also have worked with others that I'm sure will be testifying today, and I want to bring to your attention on OLIS that we had the Homeowner Association representative, Jean Grant, who put in quite a bit of information that talked about the homeowners associations and what they hope. They felt, and I'll let them talk for themselves, but one of the things we were trying to address was they felt that this bill was too simple, too open, and it needed to have more sideboards, needed to have more legalese, as I think they were describing it. And I'll let them speak on that issue themselves. Some of the other folks believe that my bill, having both short-term and long-term application, is better than Senator Hansel's bill. I think that it's very important for us to consider Senator Hansel's bill and this bill, because I do think it does talk about different aspects of strategies on overall water use and on our futures with our very scarce resource of water. I'm going to leave it at that and answer some questions after we've heard testimony, if there are questions to be had, or if you have them now. But there are people behind me who are willing to testify and may answer those questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you very much, Representative. We'll go ahead and call up Tracy Rudden and Mark Landauer.
Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, again, Tracy Rutten, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you again to Representative McLean for her attention to this issue. We do see this as a really critical issue, and that being the issue of conservation and really trying to have conversations around what it is we're going to do going forward, both short-term and long-term, to address some of the water challenges that we've seen this past year, especially. We are definitely have been engaged in the conversations. We've been talking with Senator Hansel as well as Representative. We understand there are some concerns that I imagine you'll be hearing about shortly from some of the homeowners associations. We are definitely open to addressing some of those concerns, and I think hopefully that we've been able to do that in Senator Hansel's bill. So I will, I think, just turn it over to Mark, but I do want to really extend my appreciation to Representative McLean again, because this is a really critical issue. We have received a lot of phone calls. Our cities are kind of being put in the position of playing referee on these issues, which is not a position they like to be in. So I thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions.
Please. Good afternoon, Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. I'd like to thank Representative McLean for highlighting this important issue. We are committed to continuing the conversation on how we can promote and encourage conservation with our homeowners associations. Needless to say, as a result of the drought that we had and are still experiencing in some parts of the state, we had some very desperate municipal water suppliers this summer who fortunately were able to, for the most part, voluntarily get people to reduce the amount of water and get them through the difficult months of typically September and October. However, this issue of homeowners associations requiring their members to water their lawns when there is a shortage, when there is the potential that a municipal
municipal supplier could, in fact, run out of water to be able to deliver to their customers is a very real problem. And we hope that you'll look favorably on the short-term solution, which is residing over in the Senate. We are more than happy to sit down and participate and engage in the conversation on how we can address the long-term challenges that this bill attempts to address. And I thank Representative McLean again for introducing this bill and highlighting it for the committee.
Thank you both. Are there any questions?
Can I say a question?
Yes.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Landauer, do you have any we heard about this bill in the legislative days, and when that came up, there was several of us had asked if there's any statistics or any data or anything like that. So you said this presents a very real solution, but I'm a little bit skeptical. I mean, how much does homeowner association lawn watering in the months of September and October, how much does that really impact? And I get it that it doesn't look good, you know, when drought and we're running out of water and all that, and the guy's got his sprinkler on and all that, but how much is it really going to impact?
It's an excellent question, Representative, and in fact, we have an answer for you on that. Typically, during the summer months, water usage doubles, sometimes triples, and 50% of that is attributed to irrigating lawns and gardens and washing cars. So there is a very, very measurable amount and significant amount of water that is being used in the summertime months by municipal customers. Now, Representative, that's on the broad scale. That is not focused solely on homeowners associations. So I can't answer that question in that precise of a manner. But overall, the consumption amount that's used during those summertime months more than doubles, and it's attributed largely to irrigation and car washing.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right, seeing none, thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and call up Tom Wolf, Brian Posowitz, if I can pronounce that correctly, and then Angela Crowley-Koch. Speaker, when you're ready.
Vice Chair Rayfield, Vice Chair Bueller, for the committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here to support what I believe is an excellent bill. I've sent in a testimony that you should have electronically. It covers fish stuff, but since I did that last time, I won't really talk about that. I'm going to talk about the freedom of choice. During a drought year in Washington County, where I live in the wonderful city of Hillsborough, one of the things that they notice, and they've noticed this in other drought years, is that in drought situations, people will voluntarily choose not to water their lawns, and therefore there's sometimes an alarming amount of water that is not being used because they're not watering their lawns. The problem that I have with homeowner association requirements is it doesn't give people the choice of whether to water their lawn or not. In my neighborhood, I live in the old part of Orenco, which is used to be a city of its own. Now it's been absorbed by Hillsborough. People make choices. My lawn is totally brown during the summer. Because of my conservation ethic, because of what I do, I never water my lawn. My next-door neighbor, who's a wonderful old couple, they water it. It's green. It looks great. And other people like it, but they have a choice. And I believe that Representative McLean's excellent bill offers that choice. You know, I'm not trying to condemn homeowners associations or what they do. I just believe that we're going to be facing drought situations for a long time. Even though we've had lots of water so far this year, we are looking at warm situations in the next few weeks where it's going to be sunny and warm. I've seen many snowpacks that are heavy in December and January melt away by March. So what happens if all of a sudden we don't have water available in reservoirs to do a lot of things come this summer? So I think this is a great concept that gives people in a homeowners association the choice to not water if they so choose. And I urge your yes vote on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. Vice Chairs Ray Field and Bueller. My name is Brian Posowitz. I'm a staff attorney for Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch is a river conservation organization dedicated to protecting and restoring stream flows in Oregon. And thanks to our many members and supporters, we've been around for more than 30 years now. Water Watch supports House Bill 4090, which would basically just allow somebody to conserve water by not watering outdoor landscaping, even if the rules of their HOA would otherwise require them to do that. As everybody knows, Oregon had an extreme drought last year, and the predictions are that water will become increasingly scarce in Oregon in the summer and fall months anyway. The consequences of this include fish dying in our rivers and streams because they get too low, and when they get low, they get exposed more to sun and they get too warm. For fish. The consequences can also include important out-of-stream uses of water, including possibly irrigation to grow food, getting cut off because the water rights are not as old as other water rights on the stream, which could include even municipal water rights used to do the kinds of things we're talking about, watering outdoor lawns and landscaping. Against this backdrop, we think it makes sense to try to reduce municipal water use where we can. According to the Oregon Water Resources Department website, outdoor water use accounts for almost half the water used by the American home and thus provides the greatest single opportunity for conserving. And I appreciate the question of how much of the lawn watering is actually taking place in an HOA, and I will try to see if I can find something out about that. But even assuming it's a relatively small portion, I think you have to also think about what kind of example is that setting and what is that telling the rest of the community. So I just think given this backdrop, it makes sense that somebody wanting to do the right thing by not watering their lawn and their outdoor landscaping in times of a water shortage, that they should be able to do the right thing and not be prevented by the rules of their HOA. As we understand the current law, you can have a situation where a city is having a water shortage and they're trying to get residents to voluntarily conserve water by not watering their lawns, and somebody in an HOA may want to do that and not be able to, even though they want to do that, because of the rules of the HOA. We very much respect the rights of homeowners and their rights to make agreements about what kind of neighborhood they want to live in. We just think that there should be some exceptions to that, particularly where, as here, we think circumstances may have changed since those agreements were made. I think water is becoming increasingly scarce these days. We like this bill better than the Senate bill involving the same issue, which is Senate Bill 1529. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is the Senate bill would require, it would only be triggered by an actual government drought declaration. We think the need to conserve water actually arises well before you get to that extreme situation where there's actually a government drought declaration. Also, there may be situations in which the conditions are such that there is a drought sufficient to get a drought declaration, but because, you know, sometimes of the politics of these things, there are stakeholders that for various reasons don't want the drought declaration, so you can have a situation where the conditions would justify it, but there isn't an official drought declaration, and I can get into specifics if somebody wants me to.
We also like this bill better because it would cover condominium complexes as well. In my vision of a condominium complex, there's not a lot of water use there by individuals, but the concept seems to apply, and we think it makes sense to include them. We agree that there may need to be some conditions on this bill, which just says right now an owner can refrain from watering to conserve water, and there aren't any limitations as to circumstance. I think we would be agreeable to putting some conditions on that, although we think those conditions should not be as narrow as the conditions in the Senate bill, which are only basically on an official government drought declaration.
Mr. Posowitz, if we start to begin to wrap up, we have 12 other people that need to testify on the other bill, keep mindful of the time, please.
Okay, yeah, and I'm almost done. We would be agreeable to exploring some conditions a little broader than the ones in the Senate bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, Angela Crowley Cook with Oregon Environmental Council. OEC is, we work to advance innovative, collaborative solutions to Oregon's environmental challenges for today and future generations. And I wanted to read that because I feel that Representative McClain's bill is such a innovative and collaborative solution. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward. We agree that owners of lawns in a planned community should be empowered to make their own ecologically sound choice, which makes both financial and common sense to folks. One figure I'll put out there, a 500-square-foot lawn can use more than 18,000 gallons of water per year. So that's a possible amount that could be saved. I agree with the other panelists that we prefer the House bill as opposed to the Senate bill because of the restrictions in the Senate bill. Unit owners should be able to choose to limit watering regardless of season, geography, or the current weather conditions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? All right. Seeing no questions, we'll go ahead and call up Eugene Grant. Please begin when you're ready, and also please, if you could limit the testimony a little bit, we have 12 people to get through in about 30 minutes.
I understand.
I appreciate it, thank you for your written testimony.
Yes. Chair and committee members, my name is Eugene Grant. I am a member of the Condominium and HOA Working Group. The working group consists of many different members interested in the Oregon laws regarding condominiums and planned community associations, and I've enclosed it with the letter that I submitted, information about who those members are and what that organization does. The working group represents many, if not most, of the homeowner associations in the state of Oregon. And I just want to mention that I am here representing the group because I not only have a lot of experience in doing homeowner association type work as a lawyer, but I also am the former mayor of the city of Happy Valley. I was involved there in the planning commission and then on the city council as mayor for a total of 15 years. So I'm very in touch or understand the perspective of the local governments and the water suppliers. I also have not irrigated my own personal yard, which is a 1-acre lot, for about 20 plus years from when I bought the house. So I just mentioned that. I want you to know that I am personally committed to water conservation, understand the importance of this issue, that it is an issue of critical importance. The working group, for that reason, supports Senate Bill 1529 with the -1 amendments, which we requested to make exemption from the HOA requirements effective only during the period of a drought. And the reason for that is that provides the short-term solution for the most serious problem when you have a drought declaration. The HB 4090 really goes to the longer-term solution. It's not limited to just when there's a drought. And the working group recommends and is committed to working with Representative Susan McClain and the other parties of interest that have testified here today and any other parties in working with HB 4090 as a starting point to develop legislation that will provide a process for a complete and permanent conversion of all homeowner association landscaping to greater water conservation and type where there's either no or very little irrigation. Now, the beneficial purpose of HOA declarations and bylaws is to provide uniform governance of the community. If you simply try to solve this by terminating the rules and regulations of the homeowner associations, you've completely defeated the whole purpose of homeowner associations, which is to provide a uniformly attractive neighborhood or community that will enhance the property value of all of the properties and avoid a patchwork of conflicting and unattractive conditions in the community. So what we need to do is come up with legislation that provides a means and a process for these homeowners associations to convert to the conservation of water on their landscaping. And they can't do it if you just void their existing provisions. The condominium and planned communities laws require a 75% vote to amend their documents to add new provisions. It is virtually impossible to get the owners to meet that standard to adopt and replace entirely the landscaping provisions. So what we need in House Bill 4090 are provisions that will essentially give the association the ability to avoid that 75% roadblock to convert to a non-irrigated type of landscaping, and will provide essentially a substitute set of provisions that would replace those ones that are voided, and the new provisions would require the whole community to convert. That will give you the benefit of doing that. Taking the time to come up with that kind of legislation is then you're going to convert all associations.
Need to start wrapping up to be respectful to the other people
I'm almost
in the audience.
Done. The last point, though, is important. You'll get more bang for the buck out of this legislation if you do this, if you take the time to provide the conversion process so that you can convert uniformly all of the communities and not just have a patchwork of conditions that's really unattractive and violates the whole idea of homeowner associations being able to have uniform landscaping. So what we recommend is that we work during the interim with Representative McClain, all the interested parties, and come up with legislation that could be adopted in the next session, because this session is just too short
to
be able
to wrap it up,
accomplish
please.
That.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions? All right, seeing no questions, we'll go ahead. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on House Bill 4090? Anybody else going once, twice? Seeing nobody else, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4090. We'll carry over the work session on House Bill 90 to next Tuesday, February 9th. And we will go ahead and return to House Bill 4041. We have 12 people that need to testify in 20 minutes. So I'm going to ask that you be extremely brief. A lot of you are going to say have some of the same feelings. And so if you could condense that to so we can avoid as much duplication as possible, that would be great. The first three people we'll call up is Commissioner Craig Pope, Rob Bavette, and Arwin McGill. GILVSA, or you're going to have to correct me once you get up here. I apologize tremendously.
Don't we go till 3 o'clock?
4:45.
Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I'm Commissioner Craig Pope, Polk County, and I have submitted written testimony, so you all have copies of that. I won't read that to you. But I would tell you that my belief is that taking these words out of statute will open up a gap large enough for an initiative petition process once again to get started in our individual counties where we have special interest groups that want to change the outcomes or the general view of agricultural crops. And as my testimony states in the written testimony, counties do not have the capacity to do this. And we went through this battle, long, hard battle, in 2013. So I would also point out that, you know, though there may be challenges with our current statute and some of the words that are in it, this is a very complex issue, and this session is not the place for us to be deliberating this very complex issue. We need time to work through these, and I'm committed to doing that, and I know my Association of Oregon Counties is interested in doing that. And I'd also put in that it didn't occur to me until I heard Representative Buckley talking about interests in this. I also sit on the Oregon Weed Board, and it is a place where for the last couple of years we've been dealing with a considerable battle with noxious weeds expanding throughout the state that the state simply doesn't have the funding to deal with, and it's on some levels become very epidemic. And taking away state control on seeds and products of seeds can lead to more challenges with noxious weed control as well. So, and I would tell you that my experience has been one of the things I've learned on that committee is that it's been retailers of nursery products that have brought a lot of those challenges forward. We need state regulation in that regard. Counties absolutely, and cities cannot manage that. So it didn't occur to me until he had started talking about that, and I realized that there's potential problems for perhaps for cities. I can tell you I've not experienced any of those issues as a county commissioner in the last 5 years, but I can see where those problems may exist. But we need to work in partnership with state regulatory agencies on this issue going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your brevity. Mr. Bovet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be even more brief because I understand your time pressure. AOC is opposed to House Bill 4041 at this time. We do recognize that ORS 633-738, which is the Senate Bill 863, is poorly written. It needs to be rewritten as a matter of law. And so what we would like the opportunity to do in the interim is to work with the proponents of this statute, have them sit down with me and my counterpart, the League of Oregon Cities, and recraft the statute to make it functional. It's way too overbroad at this time. We don't support this particular bill or doing some surgery through this mechanism right now because, as Commissioner Pope said, it'll leave a whole lot of our members subject to litigation. One's already in pretty heavy litigation. So. Some potentially good ideas, but not ready for prime time.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Rafe.
How bad did I butcher it?
It's Erwin McGilvra. McGilvra.
All right, there was a V. All right.
Yes.
Please begin. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm here with Oregon Women for Agriculture today. I am a fourth generation Oregon farmer. The fifth generation was just born in December, and we hope that he will grow up to also be an Oregon farmer. But so my family has grown many different crops and commodities over the years. Actually, my grandfather got a stay from the military in World War II because he was growing fiber flax that was used for the parachutes for our armed services. Then afterwards, he grew onions. We've grown everything from strawberries to cucumbers from seeds or for seed, currently growing grass seed and an African grain called teff, which can be used in gluten-free cooking. And so the idea is that flexibility and innovation are just important factors to keeping our farm in the family and viable for continued generations. And when we're talking about a patchwork of possible laws to what we can grow, that limits our choices, our flexibility, our innovation to keep our farm viable.
All right, and thank you all for your brevity. Is there any questions? Yes, Representative McClain.
You were speaking, then you are not in favor of this
bill. I am not in favor of this bill. No, I oppose.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you all for taking time out of your day to be here, especially you, Mr. Bovet. We knew you otherwise wouldn't be in the building. With that, I'm going to have to apologize to everybody. We are going to stand at ease for a moment. So if there's anybody that has traveled a long distance and can only be here today to testify on this bill, if you could approach the side and just let us know. So we're going to stand at ease for a moment.
start taking testimony.
And we're back. We're going to continue to hear testimony on House Bill 4041. Thank you for your patience. And so just remind me where we need.
These three are done. These are the ones that are absolutely necessary.
Okay, so we're going to call it up a little bit out of order on the sheet because we want to make sure that the people that absolutely have to go today have an opportunity to. So can I have Marie Bauer Stagg, Marcy Wessels, Rodney Hightower, and then on deck will be Brenda.
I didn't get that. Brenda.
Okay. Thank you.
That was on. I would like to say that was on purpose.
Mm-hmm. So. That was pretty cool. So she's going to be next.
No, the first one.
And you're Brenda?
Yeah. Oh, do you want us to
know? No. I just thought, because you told me how to pronounce your name. I wanted to make sure. Okay, so we're good. So you're Marie, Marcy, and Rodney. Go in any order that you would like. Please just state your name for the record. Thank you.
Okay. My name's Macy Wessels. I'm a production manager for Barenbrug USA. I'm also a grower in the Willamette Valley. Barenbrug works with over 100 growers in Oregon alone, over 20 counties. We grow a variety of different grass seed crops, of course. One thing about Oregon is it's the grass seed capital of the world, and it's earned its name rightfully so. We produce 80% of the world's cool season grasses, which really, when you think about it, if you're almost anywhere in the world and you're standing on a lawn, a pasture, or a golf course, more than likely that seed came from Oregon at some point. One of the things that makes us such high-quality growers here in Willamette Valley is not only our weather, but our ability to place different species and different varieties where they need to go. We make those decisions based on soil types, fertility, irrigation, drainage. We're able to put different varieties where they need to go within the Willamette Valley to be the most effective and also to get the highest quality seed. Seed preemption protects us. It allows us to make those distinguish and determinations on where we want to place those throughout the state. So where I would place a bluegrass versus a perennial ryegrass is going to change dramatically all over the state. So seed preemption protects us from being able to make those type of choices. House Bill 4041 is very vague in what it's, when you start taking out those words, as Buckley was sitting up here, he finally did admit that crops could be brought into or brought back under the gun. So I'd just like to say I'm against it, and don't take away farmers' choices on what we can and can't do. It would dramatically change the seed industry as we know it.
Thank you.
Marie Bauer Stagg. I'm a fifth generation farmer and I'm opposed to 4041. My family's been farming in Linn and Lane counties for over 100 years, and on the testimony handed out, I have a map of our farm, basically of all of our fields, and it stretches from Brownsville all the way down to almost Cresswell. If it was our choice, we would all be together, but, you know, they kind of quit making land, like, probably about time my family started farming. So that's where we're at. And we don't make decisions based on where the county line is, where it's more, you know, a factor of what the soil is, what the climate is, what markets are available, you know, will it fit with our equipment that we currently have. Like, I cannot decide to grow corn tomorrow because I don't have anything to harvest corn with. Like, there's just a bunch of decisions that need to go on. We currently grow grass seed, wheat, and metafoam, and then we're always looking for alternative crops because it's nice to have a rotation, be able to clean out the grassy weeds or whatever weeds you need to clean out. And in the last few years, we've grown flax, radish seed, turnip seed, forage peas, and this year we are actually part of the canola trial by the state legislator, which is taking place in one of our fields in Lane County. So right now, seed preemption enables my farm to be able to plant, you know, any seed that's available at the state level anywhere on my entire farm, not just Linn County or Lane County. And I guess if it's that part of the bill is taken out and that part of the law is taken out, I'm, you know, it's concerning that, you know, maybe one county may have an initiative on their ballot that wants to ban the growing of grass seed or ban any other future crop that I may want to grow. And then where does that put me in my future? And any potential future for our farm for other generations to go on. So I would just encourage you that to vote no on this bill. We already have enough risk in our day-to-day life as Mother Nature, the pests, the market, and then unfortunately the government does kind of
add some risk. So I would just ask so you don't ask add any more. Thanks.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Rodney Hightower. I'm the co-owner of Stromfisher Farm in Junction City. In 2013, we testified on behalf of the seed preemption law. At that time, as you know, it was discussed that agriculture in Oregon is very diverse. There's a lot of different commodities, a lot of different growing areas. Our farm is also diverse. We grow mostly seed crops. Full transparency, we do grow a genetically engineered sugar beet crop. We've been growing sugar beets on our farm for over 40 years, and the genetically engineered ones have been in the rotation for 10 years now. They haven't caused a problem. They're one of our more lucrative crops, and our concern is that special interests could come in and create a patchwork of regulation in the state that would have a detrimental effect on our farm. There's 36 counties and over 400 cities in the state, and if they each have their own regulations, that would be extremely complicated. Now, we're lucky that our farm is in one piece, but it's in Lane County, and we can't move our farm if public opinion goes against one crop that we grow. So I would urge you to vote no against House Bill 4041. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we're going to have Brenda come up and Greg Loberg and Kelly Rudenklan. Go ahead, whatever order you'd like. Just please announce yourself for the record.
Okay. Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Brenda Furkatich. I'm from St. Paul, Oregon. I'm a third-generation farmer. I farm about 1,000 acres. We have everything from wheat to hazelnuts. We grow vegetable seeds, perennial ryegrass, tall fescue, and then also clover for seed. I'm here today to testify against this 4041. I think that it's only really going to hurt Oregon agriculture, and to me as a young farmer here, I really see that as a detriment to our industry. Agriculture is huge in the state of Oregon, and you all know that, and I hope that you all appreciate that. And this is something that is just going to make it more and more complicated for me as a young farmer and for generations to come to be able to farm in the state. I farm a lot, and I talk a lot about the legacy that our farm has. I said I'm a third-generation farmer, and I've got the fourth generation. I've got a six-week-old out in the hall, actually. And I'm hoping that he can work that same soil that I've been working for generations that my grandfather started. Three things. I would first like to say that it's very hard to farm across county lines if counties have different regulations. And if that moves down to the cities, it's going to get even more difficult. You can't keep your pollen from going across county lines. And it's going to open a whole Pandora's box. And I fear that the science behind it is not going to be in place. I think it's going to allow for a loophole for emotion to get involved in decisions around GE because there's not research dollars behind that. Secondly, I think that there are plenty of agencies who already would like and do regulate us on these issues. The USDA, the EPA, the FDA, the ODA, you know, our own state agency that is already working, already has the backing, the enforcement to be able to work for farmers and to get to the root of these issues and really find a true, non-emotional, scientific decision that should be made. The third thing I would say is that the American Farm Bureau Young Farmers and Ranchers put out a survey a few years ago, and one of the top concerns for young farmers getting into farming was red tape and regulation. I put that as my first concern because, quite frankly, I can't move my land. So my business is here to stay. I hope it's here to stay for generations. And when we first passed the seed preemption, that was something that it was a sigh of relief for me because I felt like, finally, legislators were behind us. And you guys were supporting us, and you were saying, you know, we want you to stay here. We want you to farm. And we don't want this to happen. We don't want this patchwork of regulation. And now we're here again, and I'm having to come here and testify again. And we're busy. You know, we're farmers. entrepreneurs, we're business people, we're moms and we're dads, and quite frankly, we worked really hard to get this passed at the get-go. And I think it's really positive, and I think that we need to continue to stay strong and support it, and, you know, remember those reasons that we passed it in the first place, because those reasons are still in play, and they're under pressure even more now than they ever were. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Fagan, committee members, my name is Greg Loberg. I'm the manager of West Coast Beet Seed Company. I'm also the president of the Oregon Seed Association, and I'm the public relations chair for the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. I gave the committee assistant a handout, which has 14 logos of various agricultural or otherwise natural resource associations on it. That is not my testimony, but I believe everything that's written on that handout. My testimony's been electronically submitted. I'm going to make this brief because I realize time is short. I am against House Bill 4041 because I feel that it begins to peel off some of the protections that Brenda just mentioned that we have now in state preemption. What I see in 4041 is more ambiguity, not more clarity. And so I would be very much opposed to it. Over the last couple of years, I've had a number of involvements. The governor at the time that we passed Senate Bill 863 said, well, there's still going to be conflict, so let's form a genetic engineer task force. I was named to that task force. We spent all of 2014 talking about this. In the end, we proved what we knew when we started, that we have an ideological conflict over genetically engineered and genetically modified crops. Going into the regular session in 2015, I was put on a legislative work group. Out of that came a House Bill 2509, which strengthens mediation that is hosted by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. What the Oregon Department of Ag is doing from that bill going forward is putting in a rulemaking advisory committee. We meet in a couple of weeks or less to flesh out House Bill 2509, again, that strengthened mediation. So before we even implement a bill just passed to try to put Oregon agriculture, all types of agriculture and farming systems, into a good place around coexistence, we're starting to propose to tweak it. We need to let 2509 develop a life of its own, flesh it out, have the rulemaking committee meet, all stakeholders on all sides of the issue meet in that committee. And so I would strongly encourage us to stay the course on Senate Bill 863. It's a statewide initiative. 4041 is going to localize control again and create a patchwork of regulations over time. Again, the Oregon Seed Association and Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association oppose House Bill 4041. Thank you.
Chair Fagan, rest of the committee. I'm Hele Rattenclaw. My husband and I, first of all, I'm here to urge you to vote no on this House Bill 4041. My husband and I, Bruce, we have a family farm. We started out with 258 acres in 1992, and today farm around 1,000 acres in Yamhill and Polk counties. We love what we do. It might not be obvious, but farmers in general are very passionate people. We love our farms, and that extends to the soil, the creek, the wildlife, everything on that farm we love. We've worked hard to improve the land that we have been entrusted. We put in grass edges along creeks and ponds to make sure no pesticide or fertilizer get into the water. We put up raptor poles to encourage birds of prey to hang out around our fields, and we have adopted no-till and minimum-till practices. As a result, we've cut down on soil erosion, and our soils are healthy and productive. These practices have not been mandated, but have been encouraged by the local soil and water conservation districts and the Federal Natural Resource and Conservation Service. We've been recognized for our efforts by both our local soil and water conservation districts. Each year we choose which crops to grow in which fields. This takes into consideration what's already been brought up, soil type, irrigation need, equipment, crop history. We also have to make money in order to stay in business. And so we look at which crops are likely to be profitable for us. We like to be diversified. That's a type of insurance for us. If something has a bad year, hopefully we don't have too much of that crop. We need a certain balance of acres to make that work. In our case, we have around a third of the farm in grass seed and about 150 acres each of wheat, radish seed, peas, and the rest of the variety of specialty seed crops and some green beans. Each crop has its own niche or fit in our operation. I'm urging you not to impose outside restrictions on this process. As I mentioned, we farm in both Yamhill and Polk counties. If we suddenly had to contend with a restriction in one of the counties, we would end up with only the fields in the other county for that crop. That would change our crop rotation, and we may end up losing the ability to fit that crop into our operation at all. I'm discouraged that I have to be here today. We already went through this process when the original bill was passed. Bringing these issues up time and again only widens the rural-urban divide instead of bringing us together. Having local communities go through contentious fights is not a good thing for our state. We've already felt this. As part of our effort to educate the public about agriculture, we post signs along the highway naming the crops that grow in that field. A couple of years ago, we had sugar beet seed growing along 99W, for Greg here. It was Roundup ready, so considered a GMO. A part of me really wanted to put a crop ID sign up. I firmly believe people have a chance to see it and realize it's not so different from other crops would help overcome some of the fear and misunderstanding. However, we did not put the sign up. We were afraid that someone might come and want to make a statement and come out in the middle of the night and damage the crop. It has happened before. So I believe this bill would only make that situation worse. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and then for our final panel, we will have, I guess we'll have to do it in two different, or Kathy Hadley and Tammy Dene. And we actually will have one other panel after that, a panel of one, so, but with a different position. So go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed in whatever order you prefer.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Hadley, and I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 4041. I farm in two different counties, as several of the other people testifying do. I farm with my father in Polk County in the Rickrail area, just west of here, and also with my husband in Marion County near Silverton, right up by Silver Creek Falls State Park, if you guys are familiar with that. Both are diversified crop and livestock farms, and I'll be very brief. It's critical that we have the certainty of uniform regulatory structures when we're making cropping decisions multiple years in advance, just as Hella just spoke to. The other thing I want to bring up is, I don't know if any of you are familiar, but I wanted to discuss the AC21 committee and what came out of that. For those of you that might not know, it's an advisory committee on biotechnology and 21st century agriculture. It was chartered in 2003 with the goal of examining long-term impacts of biotech and providing guidance on pressing issues related to that. In 2011, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack reconvened that committee, and with a broad-based group representing a variety of ag interests and expertise, including organic, conventional, and GE growers. And the final report that came out in 2012 from that group had two key recommendations, taking in all accounts of all sides of the discussion. And those recommendations were that cooperation and collaboration among farmers is the most productive way to solve these issues. I know personally I'm also involved with the canola issue, and this fall we had a conversation with one of our neighbors that's raising cabbage seed. We worked out what we were going to do, not the companies, not because of a state law, farmer to farmer talking to each other. For people that can't get along, ODA has an excellent mediation program that I just sat in a seminar and learned a lot about here a couple weeks ago. The other key recommendation that came out of that AC21 committee was suggesting some sort of insurance program, because the reality is there are other countries that we're doing business with that have specific tolerances on GMOs, and if the threat of contamination exists and that can be documented, that could hurt contracts. Simply have an insurance program that's going to step in and protect those growers so they don't lose the value in that crop. And there's mechanisms existing already between with the risk management agency, the crop insurance programs under the Farm Bill. There's ways to do something like that that would solve this problem. So like I just said, you know, we've got programs that can address both aspects of that I just mentioned. The statewide preemption, seed preemption, to me, is critical to provide certainty for our industry moving forward in the future. And above all, I'm also a mother of two young boys, and I want them to have the farm to come back to and participate in for their lives and hopefully their children's lives as well. So please oppose House Bill 4041. Thank you.
Thank you. Please be going. You're ready.
Yes, members of the committee, vice chairs, my name is Tammy Denny. I am the legislative director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. You've heard from our local farmers and their opposition to this bill. We also, as an association, want to bring to your attention a very important economic engine of the state, and that is the dairy industry, representing from the farm gate value $650 million in just fluid milk. That's before it's processed into the wonderful products that are in addition to the fluid milk, cheese, yogurt, and many others. So this is an industry that depends upon the cropping systems. They depend upon the corn and other crops that are genetically engineered and have been approved for production. So the feed source for the dairy industry is very critical and very important to the state of Oregon. We want to be certain that that goes on the record. One of our dairy operators has written testimony. Her name is Bobby Harold Frost, and that testimony has been entered into the record. I encourage you to read that. She is expecting a child at this time, and that will be their fifth generation farmer that will be on their land. This is an important industry. It's multi-generations. It deserves to be protected and preserved for generations to come, as do all of our other farmers in the state of Oregon. So we want to be certain that the policies we adopt really take into the account the value of agriculture statewide. So thank you so much for your time. And hopefully we still have time for a couple of additional farmers that remain in the gallery.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And are there any questions?
They're all gone.
All right, seeing no questions.
Thank you.
Thank you again. We only have one other person on the sign-up sheet for House Bill 4041. We are already over time, and so I'm going to call up the last person. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Ivan, please come on down. Is there anybody else? All right.
Keep going.
Okay. Please begin when you're ready.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. I'll try to keep it brief in respect to your time. We're an organization that represents small and mid-sized farmers across Oregon. A number of who are concerned about lax oversight at both the federal and the state level around genetically engineered crops. I wasn't intending to testify on this bill today. We're neutral. But we appreciate the issue that Representative Buckley is trying to bring forward. We also appreciate that the Association of Oregon Counties, which supports of the bill 2 years ago, has noted that it does have some flaws. But we felt we needed to speak out today because there was clear legislative let me back up 1 second and say we're neutral on this bill, but we favor a more tailored approach, and I think you're going to hear a little bit more about something like that regarding genetically engineered crops next Tuesday. But we opposed a preemption 2 years ago because, one, we favor local control, but we also felt that those proponents of a statewide perspective needed to be articulating what that should be and what sort of statewide regulatory approach should be. I, as well as Greg, who spoke earlier, did serve on the governor's task force on genetically engineered agriculture. We spent a lot of time on that. And we were frustrated with the process because we felt that those folks who said they supported a statewide role for Oregon Department of Agriculture really brought no meaningful solutions to the table. We tried very hard. In fact, at the end of the day, Governor Kitzhaber had introduced a bill that would have just clarified, and this is one of the recommendations of the task force, just clarifying for Oregon Department of Agriculture what their role is, to clarify that they can use an existing control area authority around genetically engineered crops if the best science tells them so. And some of the groups that are opposed to this bill and were opposed to that called that draconian. So there's a real challenge here. I think it's really incumbent on those who oppose this bill to articulate very specifically what sort of statewide regulatory approach and perhaps the funding behind that would need to be enacted. I'll just add a couple more pieces here. There are real financial risks for farmers that grow traditional crops, whether they are organic or conventional. Northwest alfalfa producers have had exports turned away by countries that have a low or zero tolerance for alfalfa. We've got major lawsuits between companies like Cargill DuPont over corn that it wasn't approved for the Chinese market. So there are real economic impacts here. There are real needs for real protections, and that's what we're lacking. And that's why, you know, we do at least support the ability of local communities to enact some of those. Another big issue is there's a huge amount of seed consolidation going on in the seed industry. We've just learned that Syngenta, one of the major seed companies, is being bought out by a company owned partially by the Chinese government. And so we're going to see less and less choice for seed growers. Regarding that mediation bill, while mediation is a great approach, what is that going to mean if you are you going to have to mediate with the Chinese government if you get contaminated at some point? We don't know, and that's really problematic. We think that's not a full solution to some of these issues. The last thing I'll just throw in here is that this control area authority I mentioned, which the state already has, it's being used right now to keep Roundup Ready bent grass out of the Willamette Valley to protect the grass seed industry. It's not Oregon Department of Agriculture. If they were to come here today, they would tell you that the only reason they use that is because that was never technically deregulated by the federal government. We now know that Monsanto and Scotts, the developers of that grass, are seeking deregulation. Now, what Oregon Department of Agriculture has told us is that once that happens, should it happen, they would have no more ability at the state level to use an existing state authority to keep that out of the valley and to protect the grass seed industry. It's those type of situations where perhaps we do need some more local control if the state's not going to step up to the plate. And so thank you for your time today. I wanted to give you some perspective.
Thank you very much. Yep. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
And last call for people to testify on House Bill 4041. Okay, seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4041, and we're going to carry over the work session to next Tuesday. And we're also going to carry over the work session on House Bill 4065 until next Tuesday. All right, with that, I will entertain a motion for reconsideration.
We need to reopen the work session.
Take a motion for reconsideration.
Madam Chair, I move to reconsider House Bill 4136.
Representative Rayfield has moved to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 4136 was reported to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Chair Fagan, today has been a very valuable lesson for me as far as the need to over-communicate. And so thank you for taking the time to reconsider this and allow us to have another conversation here in just a moment.
Thank you. Happy to do so. And we, as February definitely moves quickly, we will all do our best to try to even ask questions, even if things have not been necessarily reported to us. So thank you for that. And with that, is there any further discussion on the motion? Okay, the motion before us is to reconsider the vote by which we reported House Bill 4136 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. The clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Colby?
Yes.
Representative Hoyle?
Yes.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Nearman?
No.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Mueller?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Fagan?
Yes.
Does it require more than a...
All right, the motion carries. We're now back in work session. I will entertain a motion on the Dash 1 amendment.
Chair Fagan, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated February 2nd, 2016.
Representative Bueller moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated February 2nd, 2016. Representative McClain, would you like to present your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike McClain. I represent House District 55. I put in the Dash 1 amendment because of listening to the hearing, or at least part of it, in Ledge Days in January. Representative Stark had asked a question about capping of attorney's fees if we were to move the award of non-economic damages for wrongful death 300%, and at that time the answer I believe that came from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association was that it was an informational hearing and so wasn't appropriate to answer at that time. So this amendment would have the effect of capping contingency fee agreements to the first $500,000 of non-economic damages. This would allow what is a similar, not necessarily exactly the same, but in a when you raise the wrongful death recovery for non-economic damages, it's generally the same. Now, I've had some contingency fee cases, but not that many. So I admit I have a deficit in. Vice Chair Rayfield probably has more than me on this, but generally speaking, the effort in the case is not substantially increased. I think it's a very similar case. The cap just moves. So the idea is that this would limit the amount of attorney's fees that could be awarded on the amount over $500,000 up to the $1.5 million new cap, and that would increase the actual return to the prevailing plaintiff. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any further discussion or any questions for Representative McLean, Representative Stark?
Yeah, Madam Chair, is Mr. Tower is able to?
He's not here, no.
Okay, I watched him leave just 3 minutes ago. That's frustrating. I guess I will, if with permission, I'll ask the questions of Representative McLean, and maybe Representative Rayfield can help answer if he understands my questions better. Is that permissible? So I thank you. Representative McLean, I had hoped to get a response from the trial lawyers because I asked them, as you said, back in the legislative days on what their stance would be if we were to cap it so that any additional amount we really made sure was going to the victim. So I guess I can throw out three questions, and maybe between the two of you, those who know this better can answer for me, I hope. I would like to hear, what is the process of how are the fees distributed, and how are the fees determined? Like when there's an award made of $500,000, does the victim actually get all that, or does it get split up in different ways? I know there's some that are fees, and what's the kind of the normal percentage? Along those lines, I'm curious, does an additional a higher award require additional work? If so, then okay, pay him more. If not, my question is, well, can we make sure the victim is getting all that? And then the third question is, I just wanted to hear the thoughts from the Trial Lawyers Association specifically to this amendment, but I guess he left a couple minutes ago.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Stark, I'm certain that we could make sure those three questions are put to Mr. Towers from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Perhaps he could respond in writing to you, and you can make it a part of the record. I think in the short answer is that every case is different, but if all we're doing is moving the cap, I think it's very similar work. But I confess that there may be information that the trial lawyers or those who practice like that have that I don't have.
Go ahead.
And just as you looked at me in general, and Representative McLean keeps staring at me, I would agree with Representative McLean that, the cases are very different. There's a lot of this is a broader policy discussion as far as, exactly how cases work, what are the elements to various fee agreements and things like that I think I don't feel comfortable answering on behalf of all attorneys that practice under this in all the different areas of law. And so I think that it would be best and take Representative McLean's recommendation that we just get the answers a little bit later.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to make sure I'm not violating protocol. May I ask
him? Yes.
Rep. Rayfield, in general, to my understanding of what has been shared throughout this time, when an attorney represents someone, they have no idea what the award is going to be unless there's negotiations and they settle outside of going in. So the award might be $200,000, could be $500,000, it could be $3 million. we've talked about it, even though we haven't gotten the numbers of how often it happens, they have no idea. And so I would imagine that the award would be, that the amount of work that it would take would be the exact same. I would rather see, if we are going to raise the cap, I would rather make sure that that money is going to this victim that, like, that the jury thinks it's going to. And that's all I'm trying to figure out is, can we consider a way to make sure that, yeah, let's help them more, but let's get them all that help.
And there is actually a really broad, I respond? If that premise was true, right, I would agree with you. This is a much broader policy conversation that, quite frankly, we would want to have people bring testimony forward to talk about some of the nuances. It is not as simple as every single case takes the same amount of work. There's varying levels of risk, varying levels of investment, and losses, across the spectrum. And this is, I'm trying to speak at a high level because there's different types of cases and they work very differently. I think if we were really going to consider something like this, you would want to have a policy discussion with, folks on both sides, folks doing, and be able to talk about that. Have some, evidence coming in here where we could look at some of the various different examples and thoroughly discuss this. But right now, that is where, and you and I, and I know we're about 20 minutes over time, I'm more than happy to sit down with you in my office and kind of go through some of this stuff, but I would feel more comfortable if we had a broader spectrum of attorney that also was able to chime in as well.
Well, and Madam Chair and Representative Stark, every plaintiff's attorney has the same ethical duty to zealously advocate for the interests of his or her clients. And so that alone would have us think that they're going to put in the same effort if whether 4136 passes or not. And what I'm saying is there's that little area where I don't do a lot of this practice. There may be things I'm not thinking of, but I think generally speaking it's true that it is going to be the same effort. Is it exactly the same? I don't know. But one thing's for sure, to maximize the amount that goes to the victim, I would urge the committee to adopt the Dash-1 amendment.
Let me just add really quickly. So the evidence that has been before, I appreciate that you overheard some of what was going on in the informational hearing, but the evidence that's been before the committee has been that because of the low cap as it currently is, a lot of cases are pushed to settle. So I don't know if you're suggesting that if somebody settles a case under the current cap or goes all the way to trial, because now there isn't as much incentive for an insurance company to offer that kind of initial settlement. If somebody settles a case before going to trial versus going all the way to trial, there's a significantly greater amount of effort that would go. I mean, trial preparation consumes somebody's life for 4 or 5 months or 3 or 4 months. So I don't think it's fair actually to say that there's the same amount of effort. You may not have heard the public hearing portion of this bill where there was testimony saying these often result in settlement because somebody will get offered $400,000 from an insurance company, and they'll go, okay, I can roll the dice and go all the way to trial and at most get $100,000 more and yet incur, fees, expert witness fees, all the different costs of trial, or I could just take this settlement. So I don't think it's actually fair to say it's the same amount of work, because in theory, if we would lift the cap, there might be cases where people did not have to take an artificially low settlement and were actually able to be heard before a jury, and there's a lot more work involved with settlement versus trial, which I'm assuming you know. So,
well, certainly, Madam Chair, I've taken cases to trial and I've settled them, and I can agree with you absolutely that going through to completion of a trial is more work than settling prior to trial.
The one last thing that I would clarify is we, just like when we have ethical duties to put that same amount of effort, and I'm talking about workload versus effort, because it doesn't matter how small or how large the case is, you're putting in the same amount of effort as you go through these things. But Representative Stark, the one thing that I would say that is really critical and that we must always know is that as a licensed professionals, and it does not matter what profession you're in, whether you're doing contracts, litigation to shut off lights.
This happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
Is the attorney?
Okay, so,
I know. Yeah. Okay. So
I promised I didn't coach her to do that.
I think you did, but it was okay. So getting back to what I was saying, no matter what case you are in, we have an ethical requirement not to charge an excessive fee. And when you think about this from, and if we do, we are subject to having these things reviewed and getting in trouble. And really, the premise is for these types of cases that because there's so many different types and nuances in the cases. Two people, an attorney and a client, sit down together. They look at the complexities of a given case. They look at the give and take, the amount of work, not effort, but the amount of work that's involved. And they both sit down together and agree to contract on a specific amount. Knowing that the attorney can never take advantage of somebody because there's that ethical requirement against it. And so I think that that's a good context to kind of put to the discussion.
Madam Chair, this will be my last.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, again, thank you for taking the time to have this conversation. I'm frustrated because that was very similar to the answer that Representative Rayfield, you gave me the previous time. The whole purpose of these amendments was because when I asked the Trial Lawyers Association their thoughts on it, they wouldn't answer. So I'm sitting here still really frustrated. Thank you to you for opening this back up. Thank you for responding. I'm specifically very frustrated that I watched the lobbyists for the Trial Lawyers Association walk out of the room moments before we open this discussion back up. That's very frustrating for me because I'm sitting here at the exact same spot I was before. Thank you for procedurally doing what you didn't have to do and let us talk about this. But so Trial Lawyers Association, please let me know how you feel on this because I asked over and over and over, and now it's going to move on without me hearing from them. So at that, I will stop my questions.
Genuinely, you may come to my office, whether in my personal practice, and I will spend hours with you and walk through that, just kind of like I would like to do with Representative Bueller's practice. No, not that.
There will be a fee.
Contingent fee.
Thank you. I
Okay, is there any further discussion? Is there anything else you'd like to add, Representative?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, will the clerk please call the roll?
On the dash.
This is on
the dash one amendment.
Yes.
Representative Holby?
No.
Representative Wild?
No.
Representative McClain?
No.
Representative Meerman?
Yes.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bueller?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
No.
Chair Fagan?
No. And the motion fails. That's my phone. That's the block. There we go. And then I need to entertain a new motion on the underlying bill.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4136 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 4136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Just a statement. We asked a lot of questions Tuesday that we still haven't gotten answers to. And so I would still love, as this continues to move to the other side of the building, some answers to some of the data we asked for, how it's going to affect the rural physicians and the subsidy program. I still think we need to take a look at those. So, thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Representative Stark. We've asked a lot of questions. I have asked a lot of questions as well of the medical side of this discussion that I still have not gotten one response to.
Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Coyle?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Newman?
No.
Representative Stark?
No.
Vice Chair Bueller?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Fagan?
Yes. The motion carries, and we'll still have Representative Gallegos carry the bill. We've already carried everything over. In good shape. All right, without further ado, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.
Somebody owes me a beer.
I know. Let's go to the Majority Leader's office and have a cup.
You guys
let's go to the Majority Leader's office and have a cup.
You guys did.